yesterday. That was her marker, her way in. Rose stared at the picture of Aniston with fixed and dreamy eyes. But what she was really looking for was Sam's meat counter, where every cut is a blue ribbon cowboy cut. She was looking for herself, and after a gratifyingly short search, found her. At first, just an auditory trace, the sound of supermarket muzak. Then a shopping cart. Beyond it, all was still dark. That was all right. The rest would come. Rose followed the muzak, now echoing and distant. It was dark. It was dark. It was dark. Then a little light, and a little more. Here was the supermarket aisle. Then it became a hallway, and she knew she was almost in. Her heartbeat kicked up a notch. Lying on her bed, she closed her eyes, so if the kid realized what was happening, unlikely but not impossible, she would see nothing. Rose took a few seconds to review her primary goals. Name, exact location, extent of knowledge, anyone she might have told. Turn, world. She gathered her strength and pushed. This time, the sensation of revolving wasn't a surprise, but something she had planned for and over which she had complete control. For a moment, she was still in that hallway, the conduit between their two minds, and then she was in a large room where a little girl in pigtails was riding a bike and lilting a nonsense song. It was the little girl's dream, and Rose was watching it. But she had better things to do. The walls of the room weren't real walls, but file drawers. She could open them at will now that she was inside. The little girl was safely dreaming in Rose's head, dreaming she was 5 and riding her first bicycle. That was very fine. Dream on, little princess. The child rode past her singing la 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 and seeing nothing. There were training wheels on her bike, but they flickered on and off. Rose guessed the princess was dreaming of the day when she had finally learned to ride without them. Always a very fine day in a child's life. Enjoy your bicycle, dear, while I find out all about you. Moving with confidence, Rose opened one of the drawers. The instant she reached inside, an ear-splitting alarm began to bray, and brilliant white spotlights blazed on all around the room, beating down on her with heat as well as light. For the first time in a great many years, Rose the Hat, once Rose O'Hara from County Antrim in Northern Ireland, was caught completely off guard. Before she could pull her hand out of the drawer, it slammed shut. The pain was enormous. She screamed and jerked backward, but she was held fast. Her shadow jumped high on the wall, but not just hers. She turned her head and saw the little girl bearing down on her. Only she wasn't little anymore. Now she was a young woman wearing a leather jerkin with a dragon on her blooming chest and a blue band to hold back her hair. The bike had become a white stallion. Its eyes, like those of the warrior woman, were blazing. The warrior woman had a lance. You came back. Dan said you would, and you did. And then, unbelievable in a rube, even one loaded with big steam. Pleasure. Good. The child who was no longer a child had been lying in wait for her. She had laid a trap. She meant to kill Rose. And considering Rose's state of mental vulnerability, she probably could. Summoning every bit of her strength, Rose fought back, not with some comic book lance, but with a blunt battering ram that had all her years and will behind it. Get away from me! Get the fuck back! No matter what you think you are, you're just a little girl! The girl's grown-up vision of herself, her avatar, kept coming, but she flinched as Rose's thought hit her, and the lance crashed into the wall of file drawers to Rose's immediate left instead of into her side,
which was where it had been aimed.
The kid, that's all she is, Rose kept telling herself, wheeled her horse away, and Rose turned to the drawer that had caught her. She braced her free hand above it and pulled with all her might, ignoring the pain. At first the drawer held, then it gave a little, and she was able to pull out the heel of her hand. It was scraped and bleeding. Something else was happening. There was a fluttering sensation in her head as if a bird were flying around up there. What new shit was this? Expecting that goddamn lance to drive into her back at any moment, Rose yanked with all her might. Her hand slipped all the way out, and she curled her fingers into a fist just in time. If she'd waited even an instant, the drawer would have cut them off when it slammed shut. Her nails throbbed, and she knew when she had a chance to look at them, they would be plum-colored with trapped blood. She turned. The girl was gone. The room was empty. But that fluttering sensation continued. If anything, it had intensified. Suddenly the pain in her hand and wrist was the last thing on Rose's mind. She wasn't the only one who had ridden the turntable, and it didn't matter that her eyes were still shut back in the real world, where she lay on her double bed. The fucking brat was in another room filled with file drawers. Her room. Her head. Instead of the burglar, Rose had become the burgled. Get out, get out, get out, get out! The fluttering didn't stop. It sped up. Rose shoved away her panic, fought for clarity and focus, found some. Just enough to set the turntable in motion again, even though it had become weirdly heavy. Turn world. As it did, she felt a maddening flutter in her head first diminish and then cease as the little girl was rotated back to wherever she came from. Except that's not right. And this is far too serious for you to indulge in the luxury of lying to yourself. You came to her and walked right into a trap. Why? Because in spite of all you knew, you underestimated. Rose opened her eyes, sat up, and swung her feet onto the carpet. One of them struck the empty canister and she kicked it away. The sidewinder t-shirt she had pulled on before lying down was damp. She reeked of sweat. It was a piggy smell, entirely unattractive. She looked unbelievingly at her hand, which was scraped and bruised and swelling. Her fingernails were going from purple to black, and she guessed she might lose at least two of them. But I didn't know, she said. There was no way I could. She hated the whine she heard in her voice. It was the voice of a querulous old woman. No way at all. She had to get out of this goddamn camper. It might be the biggest, luxiest one in the world, but right now it felt the size of a coffin. She made her way to the door, holding on to things to keep her balance. She glanced at the clock on the dashboard before she went out. 10 to 2. Everything had happened in just 20 minutes. Incredible. How much did she find out before I got free of her? How much does she know? No way of telling for sure. But even a little could be dangerous. The brat had to be taken care of, and soon. Rose stepped out into the pale early moonlight and took half a dozen long, steadying breaths of fresh air. She began to feel a little better, a little more herself, but she couldn't let go of that fluttering sensation, the feeling of having someone else inside her, a rube, no less, looking at her private things. The pain had been bad, and the surprise of being trapped that way was worse, but the worst thing of all was the humiliation and sense of violation. She had been stolen from. You are going to pay for that, princess. You just messed in with the wrong bitch. A shape was moving toward her. Rose had settled on the top step of her RV, but now she stood up tense, ready for anything. Then the shape got closer, and she saw it was Crow. He was dressed in pajama bottoms and slippers. Rose, I think you better... He stopped. What the hell happened to your hand? Never mind my fucking hand, she snapped. What are you doing here at 2 in the morning? Especially when you knew I was apt to be busy.
It's Grandpa Flick, Crow said. Apron Annie says he's dying. Chapter 11. Tommy, 25. 1. Instead of pine-scented air freshener and Alcazar cigars, Grandpa Flick's Fleetwood this morning smelled of shit, disease, and death. It was also crowded. There were at least a dozen members of the True Knot present, some gathered around the old man's bed, many more sitting or standing in the living room, drinking coffee. The rest were outside. Everyone looked stunned and uneasy. The True wasn't used to death among their own. "Clear out," Rose said. "Crow and Nut, you stay."
"Look at him," Petty the Chink said in a trembling voice. "Them spots! And he's cycling like crazy, Rose! Oh, this is horrible!"
"Go on," Rose said. She spoke gently and gave Petty a comforting squeeze on the shoulder when what she felt like doing was kicking her fat cockney ass right out the door. She was a lazy gossip, good for nothing but warming Barry's bed and probably not very good at that. Rose guessed that nagging was more Petty's specialty, when she wasn't scared out of her mind, that is.
"Come on, folks," Crow said. "If he is going to die, he doesn't need to do it with an audience."
"He'll pull through," Harpman Sam said. "Tougher'n a boiled owl, that's Grandpa Flick."
But he put his arm around Baba the Russian, who looked devastated, and hugged her tight against him for a moment. They got moving, some taking a last look back over their shoulders before going down the steps to join the others. When it was just the three of them, Rose approached the bed.
Grandpa Flick stared up at her without seeing her. His lips had pulled back from his gums. Great patches of his fine white hair had fallen out on the pillowcase, giving him the look of a distempered dog. His eyes were huge and wet and filled with pain. He was naked except for a pair of boxer shorts, and his scrawny body was stippled with red marks that looked like pimples or insect bites. She turned to Walnut and said, "What in hell are those?"
"Coplic spots," he said. "That's what they look like to me anyway, although coplics are usually just inside the mouth."
"Talk English."
Nut ran his hands through his thinning hair. "I think he's got the measles."
Rose gaped in shock, then barked laughter. She didn't want to stand here listening to this shit. She wanted some aspirin for her hand, which sent out a pain pulse with every beat of her heart. She kept thinking about how the hands of cartoon characters looked when they got whopped with a mallet.
"We don't catch rube diseases."
"Well, we never used to."
She stared at him furiously. She wanted her hat. She felt naked without it, but it was back in the Earth Cruiser.
Nut said, "I can only tell you what I see, which is red measles, also known as rubeola."
A rube disease called rubeola. How too fucking perfect. "That is just horseshit." He flinched, and why not? She sounded strident even to herself, but, ah, Jesus God, measles? The oldest member of the True Knot dying of a childhood disease even children didn't catch anymore.
"That baseball-playing kid from Iowa had a few spots on him, but I never thought. Because, yeah, it's like you say, we don't catch their diseases."
"He was years ago."
"I know. All I can think is that it was in the steam and it kind of hibernated. There are diseases that do that, you know. Lie passive sometimes for years, then break out."
"Maybe with rubes." She kept coming back to that. Walnut only shook his head. "If Gramps got it, why don't we all have it?"
"Because those childhood diseases, chickenpox, measles, mumps, run through rube kids like shit through a goose. It doesn't make sense."
Then she turned to Crow Daddy and promptly contradicted herself.
"What the fuck were you thinking when you let a bunch of them in to stand around and breathe his air?"
Crow just shrugged, his eyes never leaving the shivering old man on the bed. Crow's narrow, handsome face was pensive.
"Things change," Nut said. Just because we had immunity to rube diseases 50 or 100 years ago doesn't mean we have it now. For all we know, this could be part of a natural process.
Are you telling me there's anything natural about that?
She pointed to Grandpa Flick.
A single case doesn't make an epidemic, Nut said. And it could be something else. But if this happens again, we'll have to put whoever it happens to in complete quarantine.
Would it help? He hesitated a long time.
I don't know. Maybe we do have it, all of us. Maybe it's like an alarm clock set to go off or dynamite on a timer. According to the latest scientific thinking, that's sort of how rubes age. They go long and go long pretty much the same, then something turns off in their genes. The wrinkles start showing up, and all at once they need canes to walk with.
Crow had been watching Grandpa. There he goes. Fuck. Grandpa Flick's skin was turning milky, then translucent. As it moved toward complete transparency, Rose could see his liver, the shriveled gray-black bags of his lungs, the pulsing red knot of his heart. She could see his veins and arteries like the highways and turnpikes on her in-dash GPS. She could see the optic nerves that connected his eyes to his brain. They looked like ghostly strings. And then he came back. His eyes moved, caught Rosie's, held them. He reached out and took her unhurt hand. Her first impulse was to pull away. If he had what Nut said he had, he was contagious. But what the hell? If Nut was right, they had all been exposed.
Rose, he whispered, don't leave me.
I won't. She sat down beside him on the bed, her fingers entwined in his. Crow.
Yes, Rose.
The package you had sent to Sturbridge. They'll hold it, won't they?
Sure.
All right. We'll see this through, but we can't afford to wait too long. The little girl is a lot more dangerous than I thought. She sighed. Why do problems always come in bunches?
Did she do that to your hand somehow?
That was a question she didn't want to answer directly.
I won't be able to go with you, because she knows me now.
Also, she thought but didn't say, because if this is what Walnut thinks it is, the rest will need me here to play Mother Courage.
But we have to have her. It's more important than ever.
Because?
If she's had the measles, she'll have the rube immunity to catching it again. That might make her steam useful in all sorts of ways.
The kids get vaccinated against all that crap now, Crow said.
Rose nodded. That could work, too. Grandpa Flick once more began to cycle. It was hard to watch, but Rose made herself do it. When she could no longer see the old fellow's organs through his fragile skin, she looked at Crow and held up her bruised and scraped hand.
Also, she needs to be taught a lesson.
2. When Dan woke up in his turret room on Monday, the schedule had once more been wiped from his blackboard and replaced with a message from Abra. At the top was a smiley face. All the teeth were showing, which gave it a gleeful look. She came. I was ready, and I hurt her. I really did. She deserves it, so hooray! I need to talk to you. Not this way or that. Same place as before. 3 p.m. Dan lay back on his bed, covered his eyes, and went looking for her. He found her walking to school with three of her friends, which struck him as dangerous in itself, for the friends as well as for Abra. He hoped Billy was there and on the job. He also hoped Billy would be discreet and not get tagged by some zealous neighborhood watch type as a suspicious character. I can come. John and I don't leave until tomorrow, but it has to be fast and we have to be careful. Yes. Okay, good.
3. Dan was once more seated on a bench outside the ivy-covered Aniston Library when Abra emerged, dressed for school in a red jumper and snazzy red sneakers. She held a knapsack by one strap. To Dan, she looked as if she'd grown an inch since the last time he'd seen her. She waved.
Hi, Uncle Dan.
Hello, Abra. How was school?
Great.
I got an A on my biology report.
Sit down a minute and tell me about it. She crossed to the bench, so filled with grace and energy she almost seemed to dance. Eyes bright, color high, a healthy after-school teenager with all systems showing green. Everything about her said, ready, steady, go. There was no reason for this to make Dan feel uneasy, but it did.
One very good thing, a nondescript Ford pickup was parked half a block down, the old guy behind the wheel sipping a takeout coffee and reading a magazine. Appearing to read a magazine, at least.
Billy?
No answer. But he looked up from his magazine for a moment, and that was enough.
Okay, Dan said in a lower voice. I want to hear exactly what happened.
She told him about the trap she had set, and how well it had worked. Dan listened with amazement, admiration, and that growing sense of unease. Her confidence in her abilities worried him. It was a kid's confidence, and the people they were dealing with weren't kids.
I just told you to set an alarm, he said when she had finished.
This was better. I don't know if I could have gone at her that way if I wasn't pretending to be Daenerys in the Game of Thrones books, but I think so. Because she killed the baseball boy and lots of others. Also because...
For the first time, her smile faltered a little. As she was telling her story, Dan had seen what she would look like at 18. Now he saw what she had looked like at 9.
Because what?
She's not human. None of them are. Maybe they were once, but not anymore.
She straightened her shoulders and tossed her hair back. But I'm stronger. She knew it, too.
I thought she pushed you away.
She frowned at him, annoyed, wiped at her mouth, then caught her hand doing it and returned it to her lap. Once it was there, the other one clasped it to keep it still.
There was something familiar about this gesture, but why wouldn't there be? He'd seen her do it before. Right now he had bigger things to worry about.
Next time I'll be ready, if there is a next time.
That might be true, but if there was a next time, the woman in the hat would be ready too.
I only want you to be careful.
I will, for sure.
This, of course, was what all kids said in order to placate the adults in their lives, but it still made Dan feel better. A little, anyway. Besides, there was Billy in his F-150 with the faded red paint.
Her eyes were dancing again. I found lots of stuff out. That's why I needed to see you.
What stuff?
Not where she is. I didn't get that far. But I did find... See, when she was in my head, I was in hers. Like swapsies, you know? It was full of drawers, like being in the world's biggest library reference room. Although maybe I only saw it that way because she did. If she had been looking at computer screens in my head, I might have seen computer screens.
How many of her drawers did you get into?
3, maybe 4. They call themselves the True Knot. Most of them are old, and they really are like vampires. They look for kids like me, and like you were, I guess. Only they don't drink blood, they breathe in the stuff that comes out when the special kids die.
She winced in disgust. The more they hurt them before, the stronger that stuff is. They call it steam.
It's red, right? Red or reddish pink? He felt sure of this, but Abra frowned and shook her head. No, white. A bright white cloud. Nothing red about it. And listen, they can store it. What they don't use, they put in these thermos bottle thingies. But they never have enough. I saw this show once about sharks. It said they're always on the move because they never have enough to eat. I think the True Knot is like that.
She grimaced. They're naughty, all right. White stuff. Not red, but white. It still had to be what the old nurse had called the gasp, but a different kind, because it came from healthy young people instead of old ones dying of almost every disease the flesh was heir to? Because they were what Abra called the special kids? Both?
She was nodding. Both, probably.
Okay. But the thing that matters most is that they know about you. She knows.
They're a little scared I might tell someone about them, but not too scared.
Because you're just a kid and no one believes kids.
Right. She blew her bangs off her forehead. Momo would believe me, but she's going to die. She's going to your hut, Spice Dan. Hospice, I mean. You'll help her, won't you? If you're not in Iowa? All I can. Abra, are they coming for you? Maybe, but if they do, it won't be because of what I know. It will be because of what I am. Her happiness was gone now that she was facing this head on. She rubbed at her mouth again, and when she dropped her hand, her lips were parted in an angry smile. This girl has a temper, Dan thought. He could relate to that. He had a temper himself. It had gotten him in trouble more than once. She won't come, though. That bitch. She knows I know her now, and I'll sense her if she gets close, because we're sort of tied together. But there are others. If they come for me, they'll hurt anyone who gets in their way. Abra took his hands in hers, squeezing hard. This worried Dan, but he didn't make her let go. Right now she needed to touch someone she trusted. We have to stop them so they can't hurt my daddy, or my mom, or any of my friends, and so they won't kill any more kids. For a moment, Dan caught a clear picture from her thoughts, not scent, just there in the foreground. It was a collage of photos, children, dozens of them, under the heading, "Have You Seen Me?" She was wondering how many of them had been taken by the True Knot, murdered for their final psychic gasp, the obscene delicacy this bunch lived on, and left in unmarked graves. You have to get that baseball glove. If I have it, I'll be able to find out where Barry the Chunk is. I know I will, and the rest of them will be where he is. If you can't kill them, at least you can report them to the police. Get me that glove, Dan. Please. If it's where you say it is, we'll get it. But in the meantime, Abra, you have to watch yourself. I will. But I don't think she'll try sneaking into my head again. Abra's smile reemerged. In it, Dan saw the take-no-prisoners warrior woman she sometimes pretended to be. Daenerys, or whoever. If she does, she'll be sorry. Dan decided to let this go. They had been together on this bench as long as he dared. Longer, really. I've set up my own security system on your behalf. If you looked into me, I imagine you could find out what it is, but I don't want you to do that. If someone else from this knot tries to go prospecting in your head, not the woman in the hat, but someone else, they can't find out what you don't know. Oh, okay. He could see her thinking that anyone else who tried that would be sorry, too, and this increased his sense of unease. Just, if you get in a tight place, yell Billy with all your might, got that?
Yes, the way you once called for your friend Dick.
He jumped a little. Abra smiled.
I wasn't peeking. I just...
I understand. Now tell me one thing before you go.
What?
Did you really get an A on your bio report? 4. At 7:45 on that Monday evening, Rose got a double break on her walkie. It was Crow.
Better get over here, he said. It's happening.
The True was standing around Grandpa's RV in a silent circle. Rose, now wearing her hat at its accustomed gravity-defying angle, cut through them, pausing to give Andy a hug, then went up the steps, rapped once, and let herself in. Nut was standing with Big Mo and Apron Annie, Grandpa's two reluctant nurses. Crow was sitting on the end of the bed. He stood up when Rose came in. He was showing his age this evening. Lines bracketed his mouth, and there were a few threads of white silk in his black hair. We need to take steam, Rose thought, and when this is over, we will. Grandpa Flick was cycling rapidly now, first transparent, then solid again, then transparent. But each transparency was longer, and more of him disappeared. He knew what was happening, Rose saw. His eyes were wide and terrified. His body writhed with the pain of the changes it was going through.
She had always allowed herself to believe, on some deep level of her mind, in the true knot's immortality. Yes, every 50 or 100 years or so, someone died. Like that big dumb Dutchman, hands-off Hans, who had been electrocuted by a falling power line in an Arkansas windstorm not long after World War II ended. Or Katie Patches, who had drowned. Or Tommy the Truck. But those were exceptions. Usually the ones who fell were taken down by their own carelessness. So she had always believed. Now, she saw she had been as foolish as Rube children, clinging to their belief in Santa Claus and the Easter Bunny. He cycled back to solidity, moaning and crying and shivering.
Make it stop, Rosie girl. Make it stop. It hurts.
Before she could answer, and really what could she have said? He was fading again, until there was nothing left of him but a sketch of bones and his staring, floating eyes. They were the worst. Rose tried to contact him with her mind and comfort him that way, but there was nothing to hold on to. Where Grandpa Flick had always been, often grumpy, sometimes sweet, there was now only a roaring windstorm of broken images. Rose withdrew from him, shaken. Again she thought, this can't be happening.
Maybe we should put him out of his misery,
Big Mo said. She was digging her fingernails into Annie's forearm, but Annie didn't seem to feel it.
Give him a shot or something. You got something in your bag, don't you, Nut? You must.
What good would it do?
Walnut's voice was hoarse.
Maybe earlier, but it's going too fast now. He's got no system for any drug to circulate in. If I gave him hypo in the arm, we'd see it soaking into the bed 5 seconds later. Best just let it happen. It won't be long.
Nor was it. Rose counted 4 more full cycles. On the 5th, even his bones disappeared. For a moment the eyeballs remained, staring first at her, and then rolling to look at Crow Daddy. They hung above the pillow, which was still indented by the weight of his head and stained with Wild Root cream oil hair tonic, of which he seemed to have an endless supply. She thought she remembered Greedy G telling her once that he bought it on eBay. eBay, for fuck's sweet sake. Then slowly, the eyes disappeared too. Except, of course, they weren't really gone. Rose knew she'd be seeing them in her dreams later tonight. So would the others in attendance at Grandpa Flick's deathbed, if they got any sleep at all. They waited. None of them entirely convinced that the old man wouldn't appear before them again like the ghost of Hamlet's father, or Jacob Marley, or some other. But there was only the shape of his disappeared head, the stains left by his hair tonic, and the deflated pee and shit-stained boxers he had been wearing.
Mo burst into wild sobs and buried her head in Apron Annie's generous bosom. Those waiting outside heard, and one voice, Rose would never know whose, began to speak. Another joined in, then a third, and a fourth. Soon, they were all chanting under the stars, and Rose felt a wild chill go zigzagging up her back. She reached out, found Crow's hand, and squeezed it. Annie joined in. Mo next, her words muffled. Nut, then Crow. Rose the Hat took a deep breath, and added her voice to theirs.
Lodesome Hanti, we are the chosen ones. Kahana, Risone, Hanti, we are the fortunate ones. Sabatha Hanti, Sabatha Hanti, Sabatha Hanti, we are the true knot, and we endure.
5. Later, Crow joined her in her Earth cruiser.
You really won't be going east, will you?
No, you'll be in charge.
What do we do now?
Mourn him, of course. Unfortunately, we can only give him 2 days.
The traditional period was 7. No fucking, no idle talk, no steam, just meditation. Then a circle of farewell, where everyone would step forward and say one memory of Grandpa Jonas Flick and give up one object they had from him or that they associated with him. Rose had already picked hers, a ring with a Celtic design Grandpa had given her when this part of America had still been Indian country and she had been known as the Irish Rose. There was never a body when a member of the tribe died, so the objects of remembrance had to serve the purpose. Those things were wrapped in white linen and buried.
So my group leaves when? Wednesday night or Thursday morning?
Wednesday night. Rose wanted the girl as soon as possible. Drive straight through, and you're positive they'll hold the knockout stuff at the mail drop in Sturbridge.
Yes, set your mind at ease on that.
My mind won't be at ease until I can look at that little bitch lying in the room right across from mine. Drugged to the gills, handcuffed, and full of tasty, suckable steam.
Who are you taking?
Name them off.
Me? Nut? Jimmy Numbers, if you can spare him.
I can spare him. Who else?
Snakebite Andy. If we need to put someone to sleep, she can get it done. And the Chink. Him for sure. He's the best locator we've got now that Grandpa's gone. Other than you, that is.
By all means take him, but you won't need a locator to find this one, Rose said. That's not going to be the problem. And just one vehicle will be enough. Take Steamhead Steve's Winnebago.
Already spoke to him about it.
She nodded, pleased. One other thing. There's a little hole in the wall store in Sidewinder called District X.
Crow raised his eyebrows. The porno palace with the inflatable nurse doll in the window.
You know it, I see. Rose's tone was dry. Now listen to me, Daddy. Crow listened.
6.
Dan and John Dalton flew out of Logan on Tuesday morning just as the sun was rising. They changed planes in Memphis and touched down in Des Moines at 11:15 Central Daylight Time on a day that felt more like mid-July than late September. Dan spent the first part of the Boston to Memphis leg pretending to sleep so he wouldn't have to deal with the doubts and second thoughts he felt sprouting like weeds in John's mind. Somewhere over upstate New York, pretending ceased and he fell asleep for real. It was John who slept between Memphis and Des Moines, so that was all right. And once they were actually in Iowa, rolling toward the town of Freeman in a totally unobtrusive Ford Focus from Hertz, Dan sensed that John had put his doubts to bed. For the time being, at least. What had replaced them was curiosity and uneasy excitement. "Boys on a treasure hunt," Dan said. He'd had the longer nap, and so he was behind the wheel. High corn, now more yellow than green, flowed past them on either side. John jumped a little.
"Huh?"
Dan smiled. "Isn't that what you were thinking? That we're like boys on a treasure hunt?"
"You're pretty goddamn spooky, Daniel."
"I suppose. I've gotten used to it." This was not precisely true.
"When did you find out you could read minds?"
"It isn't just mind reading. The Shining's a uniquely variable talent. If it is a talent. Sometimes, lots of times, it feels more like a disfiguring birthmark. I'm sure Abra would say the same. As for when I found out, I never did. I just always had it. It came with the original equipment."
"And you drank to blot it out?"
A fat woodchuck trundled with leisurely fearlessness across Route 150. Dan swerved to avoid it, and the chuck disappeared into the corn, still not hurrying. It was nice out here, the sky looking 1,000 miles deep and nary a mountain in sight. New Hampshire was fine, and he'd come to think of it as home, but Dan thought he was always going to feel more comfortable in the flatlands. Safer.
"You know better than that, Johnny. Why does any alcoholic drink?"
"Because he's an alcoholic."
"Bingo. Simple as can be. Cut through the psychobabble and you're left with the stark truth. We drank because we're drunks."
John laughed.
KCK has truly indoctrinated you.
Well, there's also the heredity thing, Dan said. Casey always kicks that part to the curb, but it's there. Did your father drink?
Him and Mother Dearest both. They could have kept the 19th hole at the country club in business all by themselves. I remember the day my mother took off her tennis dress and jumped into the pool with us kids. The men applauded. My dad thought it was a scream. Me, not so much. I was 9, and until I went to college, I was the boy with the striptease, Mommy. Yours?
My mother could take it or leave it alone. Sometimes she used to call herself Two Beers Wendy. My dad, however. One glass of wine or can of Bud, and he was off to the races. Dan glanced at the odometer and saw they still had 40 miles to go. You want to hear a story? One I've never told anybody? I should warn you, it's a weird one. If you think The Shining begins and ends with paltry shit like telepathy, you're way short. He paused. There are other worlds than these.
You've, seen these other worlds?
Dan had lost track of John's mind, but DJ suddenly looked a little nervous, as if he thought the guy sitting next to him might suddenly stick his hand in his shirt and declare himself the reincarnation of Napoleon Bonaparte. No, just some of the people who live there. Abra calls them the ghosty people. Do you want to hear or not?
I'm not sure I do, but maybe I better.
Dan didn't know how much this New England pediatrician would believe about the winter the Torrance family had spent at the Overlook Hotel, but found he didn't particularly care. Telling it in this nondescript car, under this bright Midwestern sky, would be good enough. There was one person who would have believed it all, but Abra was too young, and the story was too scary. John Dalton would have to do. But how to begin? With Jack Torrance, he supposed. A deeply unhappy man who had failed at teaching, writing, and husbanding. What did the baseball players call 3 strikeouts in a row? The golden sombrero? Dan's father had had only one notable success. When the moment finally came, the one the Overlook had been pushing him toward from their first day in the hotel, he had refused to kill his little boy. If there was a fitting epitaph for him, it would be,
Dan.
My father tried, he said. That's the best I can say for him. The most malevolent spirits in his life came in bottles. If he'd tried AA, things might have been a lot different. But he didn't. I don't think my mother even knew there was such a thing, or she would have suggested he give it a shot. By the time we went up to the Overlook Hotel, where a friend of his got him a job as the winter caretaker, his picture could have been next to Dry Drunk in the dictionary.
That's where the ghosts were?
Yes. I saw them. He didn't, but he felt them. Maybe he had his own shining. Probably he did. Lots of things are hereditary, after all, not just a tendency toward alcoholism. And they worked on him. He thought they, the ghosty people, wanted him. But that was just another lie. What they wanted was a little boy with a great big shine, the same way this True Knot bunch wants Abra. He stopped, remembering how Dick, speaking through Eleanor Ouellet's dead mouth, had answered when Dan had asked where the empty devils were. In your childhood, where every devil comes from.
Dan, are you okay?
Yes, Dan said. Anyway, I knew something was wrong in that goddamn hotel even before I stepped through the door. I knew when the three of us were still living pretty much hand-to-mouth down in Boulder on the eastern slope. But my father needed a job so he could finish a play he was working on. 7. By the time they reached Adair, he was telling John how the Overlook's boiler had exploded and how the old hotel had burned to the ground in a driving blizzard. Adair was a 2-stoplight town, but there was a Holiday Inn Express, and Dan noted the location. That's where we'll be checking in a couple of hours from now, he told John. We can't go digging for treasure in broad daylight, and besides, I'm dead for sleep. Haven't been getting much lately. "All that really happened to you?" John asked in a subdued voice. "It really did," Dan smiled. "Think you can believe it?"
"If we find the baseball glove where she says it is, I'll have to believe a lot of things."
"Why did you tell me?"
"Because part of you thinks we're crazy to be here in spite of what you know about Abra. Also because you deserve to know that there are forces. I've encountered them before, you haven't. All you've seen is a little girl who can do assorted psychic parlor tricks like hanging spoons on the ceiling. This isn't a boy's treasure hunt game, John. If the True Knot finds out what we're up to, we'll be pinned to the target right along with Abra Stone. If you decided to bail on this business, I'd make the sign of the cross in front of you and say, 'Go with God.'"
"And continue on by yourself."
Dan tipped him a grin.
"Well, there's Billy."
"Billy's 73 if he's a day."
"He'd say that's a plus.
Billy likes to tell people that the good thing about being old is that you don't have to worry about dying young."
John pointed. "Freeman Town Line." He gave Dan a small, tight smile. "I can't completely believe I'm doing this. What are you going to think if that ethanol plant is gone? If it's been torn down since Google Earth snapped its picture and planted over with corn?"
"It'll still be there," Dan said. 8. And so it was. A series of soot-gray concrete blocks roofed in rusty corrugated metal. One smokestack still stood. Two others had fallen and lay on the ground like broken snakes. The windows had been smashed, and the walls were covered in blotchy spray-paint graffiti that would have been laughed at by the pro-taggers in any big city. A potholed service road split off from the two-lane, ending in a parking lot that had sprouted with errant seed corn. The water tower Abra had seen stood nearby, rearing against the horizon like an H.G. Wells Martian war machine. "Freeman, Iowa" was printed on the side. The shed with the broken roof was also present and accounted for. "Satisfied?" Dan asked. They had slowed to a crawl. "Factory, water tower, shed, no trespassing sign. All just like she said it would be." John pointed to the rusty gate at the end of the service road.
"What if that's locked? I haven't climbed a chain-link fence since I was in junior high."
"It wasn't locked when the killers brought that kid here, or Abra would have said."
"Are you sure of that?"
A farm truck was coming the other way. Dan sped up a little and lifted a hand as they passed. The guy behind the wheel, green John Deere cap, sunglasses, bib overalls, raised his in return but hardly glanced at them. That was a good thing.
"I asked if..."
"I know what you asked," Dan said. "If it's locked, we'll deal with it. Somehow. Now let's go back to that motel and check in. I'm whipped." 9. While John got adjoining rooms at the Holiday Inn, paying cash, Dan sought out the Adair True Value Hardware. He bought a spade, a rake, two hoes, a garden trowel, two pairs of gloves, and a duffel to hold his new purchases. The only tool he actually wanted was the spade, but it seemed best to buy in bulk.
"What brings you to Adair, may I ask?"
the clerk asked as he rang up Dan's stuff. "Just passing through. My sister's in Des Moines, and she's got quite the garden patch. She probably owns most of this stuff, but presents always seem to improve her hospitality."
"I hear that, brother. And she'll thank you for this short-handle hoe. No tool comes in handier, and most amateur gardeners never think to get one. We take MasterCard, Visa."
"I think I'll give the plastic a rest," Dan said, taking out his wallet.
"Just give me a receipt for Uncle Sugar."
"You bet. And if you give me your name and address, or your sister's, we'll send our catalog."
"You know what? I'm going to pass on that today," Dan said, and put a little fan of 20s on the counter. 10. At 11 o'clock that night there came a soft rap on Dan's door. He opened it and let John inside. Abra's pediatrician was pale and keyed up.
"Did you sleep?"
"Some," Dan said. "You?"
"In and out, mostly out. I'm nervous as a goddamn cat. If a cop stops us, what are we going to say?"
"That we heard there was a juke joint in Freeman and decided to go looking for it."
There's nothing in Freeman but corn. About 9 billion acres of it.
We don't know that, Dan said mildly. We're just passing through. Besides, no cop's going to stop us, John. Nobody's even going to notice us. But if you want to stay here...
I didn't come halfway across the country to sit in a motel watching Jay Leno. Just let me use the toilet. I used mine before I left the room, but now I need to go again. Christ, am I nervous?
The drive to Freeman seemed very long to Dan, but once they left Adair behind, they didn't meet a single car. Farmers went to bed early, and they were off the trucking routes. When they reached the ethanol plant, Dan doused the rental car's lights, turned into the service road, and rolled slowly up to the closed gate. The two men got out.
John cursed when the Ford's dome light came on. I should have turned that thing off before we left the motel, or smashed the bulb if it doesn't have a switch.
Relax, Dan said. There's no one out here but us chickens. Still, his heart was beating hard in his chest as they walked to the gate. If Abra was right, a little boy had been murdered and buried out here after being miserably tortured. If ever a place should be haunted. John tried the gate, and when pushing didn't work, he tried pulling.
Nothing. What now? Climb, I guess. I'm willing to try, but I'll probably break my fucking...
Wait. Dan took a penlight from his jacket pocket and shone it on the gate, first noting the broken padlock, then the heavy twists of wire above and below it. He went back to the car, and it was his turn to wince when the trunk light came on.
Well, shit. He couldn't think of everything.
He yanked out the new duffel and slammed the trunk lid down. Dark returned. Here, he told John, holding out a pair of gloves. Put these on. Dan put on his own, untwisted the wire, and hung both pieces in one of the chain-link diamonds for later reference. Okay, let's go.
I have to pee again.
Oh, man, hold it.
11.
Dan drove the Hertz Ford slowly and carefully around to the loading dock. There were plenty of potholes, some deep, all hard to see with the headlights off. The last thing in the world he wanted was to drop the Focus into one and smash an axle. Behind the plant, the surface was a mixture of bare earth and crumbling asphalt. 50 feet away was another chain-link fence, and beyond that, endless leagues of corn. The dock area wasn't as big as the parking lot, but it was plenty big.
Dan, how will we know where? Be quiet.
Dan bent his head until his brow touched the steering wheel and closed his eyes.
Abra?
Nothing. She was asleep, of course. Back in Anniston, it was already Wednesday morning. John sat beside him, chewing his lips.
Abra?
A faint stirring. It could have been his imagination. Dan hoped it was more.
Abra!
Eyes opened in his head. There was a moment of disorientation, a kind of double vision, and then Abra was looking with him. The loading dock and the crumbled remains of the smokestacks were suddenly clearer, even though there was only starlight to see by. Her vision's a hell of a lot better than mine. Dan got out of the car. So did John, but Dan barely noticed. He had ceded control to the girl who was now lying awake in her bed 1,100 miles away. He felt like a human metal detector. Only it wasn't metal that they were looking for.
Walk over to that concrete thing.
Dan walked to the loading dock and stood with his back to it.
Now start going back and forth.
A pause as she hunted for a way to clarify what she wanted.
Like on CSI.
He coursed 50 feet or so to the left, then turned right, moving out from the dock on opposing diagonals. John had gotten a spade out of the duffel bag and stood by the rental car watching.
Here's where they park their RVs.
Dan cut back left again, walking slowly, occasionally kicking a loose brick or chunk of concrete out of his way.
You're close.
Dan stopped. He smelled something unpleasant, a gassy whiff of decay.
Abra, do you?
Yes. Oh, God, Dan.
Take it easy, hun.
You went too far. Turn around. Go slow.
Dan turned on one heel like a soldier doing a sloppy about face. He started back toward the loading dock.
Left a little to your left, slower.
He went that way, now pausing after each small step. Here was that smell again, a little stronger. Suddenly the preternaturally sharp nighttime world began to blur as his eyes filled with Abra's tears.
There, the baseball boy. You're standing right on top of it.
Dan took a deep breath and wiped at his cheeks. He was shivering, not because he was cold, but because she was. Sitting up in her bed, clutching her lumpy stuffed rabbit and shaking like an old leaf on a dead tree.
Get out of here, Abra.
Dan, are you?
Yes, fine, but you don't need to see this.
Suddenly, that absolute clarity of vision was gone. Abra had broken the connection, and that was good.
Dan, John called low. All right?
Yes. His voice was still clogged with Abra's tears. Bring that spade.
12.
It took them 20 minutes. Dan dug for the first 10, then passed the spade to John, who actually found Brad Trevor. He turned away from the hole covering his mouth and nose. His words were muffled but understandable.
Okay, there's a body. Jesus.
You didn't smell it before?
Buried that deep and after 2 years? Are you saying that you did?
Dan didn't reply. So John addressed the hole again, but without conviction this time. He stood for a few seconds with his back bent, as if he still meant to use the spade, then straightened and drew back when Dan shone the pin light into the little excavation they had made.
I can't, he said. I thought I could, but I can't. Not with that. My arms feel like rubber.
Dan handed him the light. John shone it into the hole, centering the beam on what had freaked him out. A dirt-clotted sneaker. Working slowly, not wanting to disturb the earthly remains of Abra's baseball boy any more than necessary, Dan scraped dirt away from the sides of the body. Little by little, an earth-covered shape emerged. It reminded him of the carvings on sarcophagi he had seen in National Geographic. The smell of decay was now very strong.
Dan stepped away and hyperventilated, ending with the deepest breath he could manage.
Then he dropped into the end of the shallow grave, where both of Brad Trevor's sneakers now protruded in a V. He knee-walked up to about where he thought the boy's waist must be, then held up a hand for the penlight. John handed it over and turned away. He was sobbing, audibly. Dan clamped the slim flashlight between his lips and began brushing away more dirt. A child's T-shirt came into view, clinging to a sunken chest. Then hands. The fingers, now little more than bones wrapped in yellow skin, were clasped over something. Dan's chest was starting to pound for air now, but he pried the Trevor boy's fingers apart as gently as he could. Still, one of them snapped with a dry, crunching sound. They had buried him holding his baseball glove to his chest. Its lovingly oiled pocket was full of squirming bugs.
The air escaped Dan's lungs in a shocked whoosh, and the breath he inhaled to replace it was rich with rot. He lunged out of the grave to his right, managing to vomit on the dirt they'd taken out of the hole instead of on the wasted remains of Bradley Trevor, whose only crime had been to be born with something a tribe of monsters wanted and had stolen from him on the very wind of his dying shrieks.
13. They reburied the body, John doing most of the work this time and covered the spot with a makeshift crypt of broken asphalt chunks. Neither of them wanted to think of foxes or stray dogs feasting on what scant meat was left. When they were done, they got back into the car and sat without speaking. At last, John said, "What are we going to do about him, Dano? We can't just leave him. He's got parents, grandparents, probably brothers and sisters, all of them still wondering."
"He has to stay a while, Long enough so nobody's going to say, gee, that anonymous call came in just after some stranger bought a spade in the Adair hardware store.